This is Audible.
Dante, a brief biography by John Butler Arthur. Dante Alighieri, the greatest of Italian poets, was born at Florence about the middle of May, 1265. He was descended from an ancient family, but from one which at any rate for several generations had belonged to the burgher and not to the knightly class. His biographers have attempted on very slight grounds to deduce his origin from the Frangipani, one of the oldest senatorial families of Rome. We can affirm with greater certainty that he was connected with the Elisei, who took part in the building of Florence under Charles the Great. Dante himself does not, with the exception of a few obscure and scattered allusions, carry his ancestry beyond the warrior Cacciaguida, whom he met in the sphere of Mars in his poem. Of Cacciaguida's family, nothing is known. The name, as he told Dante in the poem, was given him at his baptism. It has a Teutonic ring. The family may well have sprung from one of the barons, who, as Villani tells us, remained behind Otto I. It has been noted that the phrase "tonde vener quivi" seems to imply that they were not Florentines. He further tells his descendant that he was born in the year 1106, or if another reading of the poem be adopted, in 1091, and that he married an Alighieri from the valley of the Po. Here the German strain appears unmistakably, the name Aldighiero, Aldega, being purely Teutonic. He also mentions two brothers, Moronti and Elisio, and that he accompanied the Emperor Conrad III upon his crusade into the Holy Land, where he died, 1147, among the infidels. From Elisio was probably descended the branch of the Elisei, from Alighiero, son of Cacciaguida, the branch of the Alighieri. Bellincione, son of Alighiero, was the grandfather of Dante. His father was a second Alighiero, a lawyer of some reputation. By his first wife, Lapa di Carissimo Cialuffi, this Alighiero had a son, Francesco. By his second, Doña Bella, whose family is not known, Dante, and a daughter. Thus the family of Dante held a most respectable position among the citizens of his beloved city. But had it been reckoned in the very first rank, they could not have remained in Florence after the defeat of the Guelphs at Monteperti in 1260. It is clear, however, that Dante's mother at least did so remain, for Dante was born in Florence in 1265. The heads of the Guelph party did not return till 1267. Dante was born under the sign of the twins, the glorious stars pregnant with virtue, to whom he owes his genius such as it is. Astrologers considered this constellation as favorable to literature and science, and Brunetto Latini, the philosopher and diplomatist, his instructor, tells him in the Inferno that if he follows its guidance, he cannot fail to reach the harbor of fame. Boccaccio relates that before his birth his mother dreamed that she lay under a very lofty laurel, growing in a green meadow by a very clear fountain, when she felt the pangs of childbirth, that her child, feeding on the berries which fell from the laurel and on the waters of the fountain, in a very short time became a shepherd, and attempted to reach the leaves of the laurel, the fruit of which had nurtured him, that, trying to obtain them, he fell and rose up no longer a man, but in the guise of a peacock. We know little of Dante's boyhood except that he was a hard student and was profoundly influenced by Brunetto Latini. Boccaccio tells us that he became very familiar with Virgil, Horace, Ovid, and Statius, and all other famous poets. From the age of 18, he, like most cultivated young men of that age, wrote poetry assiduously, in the philosophical amatory style of which his friend, older by many years than himself, Guido Cavalcanti, was a great exponent, and of which Dante regarded Guido Guinicelli of Bologna as the master. Leonardo Bruni of Arezzo, writing 100 years or more after his death, says that by study of philosophy, of theology, astrology, arithmetic, and geometry, by reading of history, by the turning over many curious books, watching and sweating in his studies, he acquired the science which he was to adorn and explain in his verses. Of Brunetto Latini, Dante himself speaks with the most loving gratitude and affection, though he does not hesitate to brand his vices with infamy. Under such guidance, Dante became master of all the science of his age at a time when it was not impossible to know all that could be known. He had some knowledge of drawing. At any rate, he tells us that on the anniversary of the death of Beatrice, he drew an angel on a tablet. He was an intimate friend of Giotto, who has immortalized his youthful lineaments in the chapel of the Bargello, and who is recorded to have drawn from his friend's inspiration the allegories of virtue and vice which fringe the frescoes in the Scrivegni chapel at Padua. Nor was he less sensible to the delights of music. Milton had not a keener ear for the loud uplifted angel trumpets and the immortal harps of golden wires of the cherubim and seraphim. And the English poet was proud to compare his own friendship with Henry Lawes with that between Dante and Casella, met in the milder shades of purgatory. Of his companions, the most intimate and sympathetic were the lawyer-poet Kino of Pistoia, La Poggiani, Guido Cavalcanti, and others, similarly gifted and dowered with like tastes, who moved in the lively and acute society of Florence, and felt with him the first warm flush of the new spirit which was soon to pass over Europe. He has written no sweeter or more melodious lines than those in which he expresses the wish that he, with Guido and Lapo, might be wafted by enchantment over the sea wheresoever they might list, shielded from tempest and foul weather in such contentment that they should wish to live always in one mind, and that the good enchanter should bring Monavanna and Monabice, and that other lady into their bark, where they should forever discourse of love and be forever happy. It is a wonderful thing, says Leonardo Bruni, that though he studied without intermission, it would not have appeared to anyone that he studied from his joyous mien and youthful conversation. Like Milton, he was trained in the strictest academical education which the age afforded. But Dante lived under a warmer sun and brighter skies, and found in the rich variety and gaiety of his early life a defense against the withering misfortunes of his later years. Milton felt too early the chill breath of Puritanism, and the serious musing on the experience of life which saddened the verse of both poets deepened in his case rather into grave and desponding melancholy than into the fierce scorn and invective which disillusion wrung from Dante. We must now consider the political circumstances in which lay the activity of Dante's manhood. From 1115, the year of the death of Matilda, Countess of Tuscany, to 1215, Florence enjoyed a nearly uninterrupted peace. Attached to the Guelph party, it remained undivided against itself. But in 1215 a private feud between the families of Buondelmonte and Uberti introduced into the city the horrors of civil war. Villani relates how Buondelmonte del Buondelmonte, a noble youth of Florence, being engaged to marry a lady of the house of Amedei, allied himself instead to a Donati, and how Buondelmonte was attacked and killed by the Amedei and Uberti at the foot of the Ponte Vecchio, close by the pilaster which bears the image of Mars. The death of Messer Buondelmonte was the occasion and beginning of the accursed parties of Guelphs and Ghibellines in Florence. Of the 72 families then in Florence, 39 became Guelph under the leadership of the Buondelmonte, and the rest Ghibelline under the Uberti. The strife of parties was for a while allayed by the war against Pisa in 1222, and the constant struggles against Siena. But in 1248, Frederick II sent into the city his natural son, Frederick of Antioch, with 1,600 German knights. The Guelphs were driven away from the town and took refuge, part in Montevarchi, part in Capraia. The Ghibellines, masters of Florence, behaved with great severity and destroyed the towers and palaces of the Guelph nobles. At last the people became impatient. They rose in rebellion, reduced the powers of the Podesta, elected a captain of the people to manage the internal affairs of the city with a council of 12, established a more democratic constitution, and, encouraged by the death of Frederick II in December 1250, recalled the exiled Guelphs. Manfred, the bastard son of Frederick, pursued the policy of his father. He stimulated the Ghibelline Uberti to rebel against their position of subjection. A rising of the vanquished party was put down by the people. In July 1258, the Ghibellines were expelled from the town, and the towers of the Uberti razed to the ground. The exiles betook themselves to the friendly city of Siena. Manfred sent them a reinforcement of German horse under his kinsman, Count Giordano Lancia. The Florentines, after vainly demanding their surrender, dispatched an army against them. On the 4th of September 1260 was fought the great battle of Montaperti, which dyed the Arbia red, and in which the Guelphs were utterly defeated. The hand which held the banner of the Republic was sundered by the sword of a traitor. For the first time in the history of Florence, the Carroccio was taken. Florence lay at the mercy of her enemies. A parliament was held at Empoli, in which the deputies of Siena, Pisa, Arezzo, and other Tuscan towns consulted on the best means of securing their new war power. They voted that the accursed Guelph city should be blotted out. But Farinata dei Uberti stood up in their midst, bold and defiant as when he stood erect among the sepulchres of hell, and said that if, from the whole number of the Florentines, he alone should remain, he would not suffer whilst he could wield a sword that his country should be destroyed, and that, if it were necessary to die 1,000 times for her, 1,000 times would he be ready to encounter death. Help came to the Guelphs from an unexpected quarter. Clement IV, elected Pope in 1265, offered the crown of Apulia and Sicily to Charles of Anjou. The French prince, passing rapidly through Lombardy, Romagna, and the Marches, reached Rome by way of Spoleto, was crowned on the 6th of January, 1266, and on the 23rd of February defeated and killed Manfred at Benevento. In such a storm of conflict did Dante first see the light. In 1267 the Guelphs were recalled, but instead of settling down in peace with their opponents, they summoned Charles of Anjou to vengeance, and the Ghibellines were driven out. The meteor passage of Conradin gave hope to the imperial party, which was quenched when the head of the fair-haired boy fell on the scaffold at Naples. Pope after pope tried in vain to make peace. Gregory X placed the rebellious city under an interdict. In 1278, Cardinal Latini, by order of Nicholas III, effected a truce, which lasted for 4 years. The city was to be governed by a committee of 14 Buonomini, on which the Guelphs were to have a small majority. In 1282, the Constitution of Florence received the final form which it retained till the collapse of freedom. From the three Arti Maggiori were chosen 6 priors, in whose hands was placed the government of the Republic. Before the end of the century, 7 greater arts were recognized, including the Speziali, druggists and dealers in all manner of Oriental goods and in books, among whom Dante afterwards enrolled himself. They remained in office for 2 months, and during that time lived and shared a common table in the public palace. We shall see what influence this office had upon the fate of Dante. The success of the Sicilian Vespers in March 1282, the death of Charles of Anjou, January 1285, and of Martin IV in the following March, roused again the courage of the Ghibellines. They entered Arezzo, where the Ghibellines at present had the upper hand, and threatened to drive out the Guelphs from Tuscany. Skirmishes and raids, of which Villani and Bruni have left accounts, went on through the winter of 1288-1289, forming a prelude to the great battle of Campaldino in the following summer. Then it was that Dante saw horsemen moving camp and commencing the assault, and holding muster, and the march of foragers, the shock of tournaments, and race of jousts, now with trumpets, and now with bells, with drums, and castle signals, with native things and foreign. On the 1st of June, 1289, at Campaldino, near Pupi, in the Casentino, the Ghibellines were utterly defeated. They never again recovered their hold on Florence, but the violence of faction survived under other names. In a letter quoted, though not at first hand, by Leonardo Bruni, which is not now extant, Dante is said to mention that he himself fought with distinction at Campaldino. He was present shortly afterwards at the Battle of Camprona, and returned in September 1289 to his studies and his love. His peace was of short duration. On the 9th of June, 1290, died Beatrice, whose mortal love had guided him for 13 years, and whose immortal spirit purified his later life and revealed to him the mysteries of paradise. Dante had first met Beatrice Portinari at the house of her father Folco on May Day, 1274. In his own words, "Already 9 times after my birth the heaven of light had returned, as it were, to the same point, when there appeared to my eyes the glorious lady of my mind, who was by many called Beatrice, who knew not what to call her. She had already been so long in this life that already in its time the starry heaven had moved towards the east the 12th part of a degree, so that she appeared to me about the beginning of her 9th year, and I saw her about the end of my 9th year. Her dress on that day was of a most noble colour, a subdued and goodly crimson, girdled and adorned in such sort as best suited with her tender age. At that moment I saw most truly that the spirit of life which hath its dwelling in the secretest chamber of the heart began to tremble so violently that the least pulses of my body shook therewith, and in trembling it said these words, 'Ecce Deus fortior me qui veniens dominabitur mihi.'" In the Vita Nuova is written the story of his passion from its commencement to within a year after the lady's death on June the 9th, 1290. He saw Beatrice only once or twice, and she probably knew little of him. She married Simone di Bardi, but the worship of her lover was stronger for the remoteness of its subject. The last chapter of the Vita Nuova relates how, after the lapse of a year, "it was given me to behold a wonderful vision, wherein I saw things which determined me to say nothing further of this blessed one, until such time as I could discourse more worthily concerning her. And to this end I labour all I can, as she in truth knoweth. Therefore, if it be his pleasure, through whom is the life of all things, that my life continue with me a few years, it is my hope that I shall yet write concerning her what hath not before been written of any woman, after the which may it seem good unto him who is the master of grace, that my spirit should go hence to behold the glory of its lady, to wit, of that blessed Beatrice who now gloriously gazes on the countenance of him, qui est per omnia secula benedictus." In the Convito he resumes the story of his life. "When I had lost the first delight of my soul," that is Beatrice, "I remained so pierced with sadness that no comforts availed me anything. Yet after some time my mind, desirous of health, sought to return to the method by which other disconsolate ones had found consolation, and I set myself to read that little-known book of Boecius, in which he consoled himself when a prisoner and in exile. And hearing that Tully had written another work in which, treating of friendship, he had given words of consolation to Lilius, I set myself to read that also. He so far recovered from the shock of his loss that, in 1292, he married Gemma, daughter of Manetto Donati, a connection of the celebrated Corsa Donati, afterwards Dante's bitter foe. It is possible that she is the lady mentioned in the Vita Nuova as sitting full of pity at her window and comforting Dante for his sorrow. By this wife he had two sons and two daughters, and although he never mentions her in the Divina Commedia, and although she did not accompany him into exile, there is no reason to suppose that she was other than a good wife, or that the union was otherwise than happy. Certain it is that he spares the memory of Corso in his great poem, and speaks kindly of his kinsmen Piccarda and Forese. In 1293, Giano della Bella, a man of old family who had thrown in his lot with the people, induced the Commonwealth to adopt the so-called Ordinances of Justice, a severely democratic constitution by which, among other things, it was enacted that no man of noble family, even though engaged in trade, could hold office as prior. 2 years later, Giano was banished, but the ordinances remained in force, though the Grandi recovered much of their power. Dante now began to take an active part in politics. He was inscribed in the Arte of the Medici and Speciale, which made him eligible as one of the six priori to whom the government of the city was entrusted in 1282. Documents still existing in the archives of Florence show that he took part in the deliberations of the several councils of the city in 1295, 1296, 1300, and 1301. The notice in the last year is of some importance. The Pope had demanded a contingent of two Florentine knights to serve against his enemies, the Colonna family. On the 19th of June, we read in the contemporary report of a debate on this question in the Council of 100. Other instances of his invariable opposition to Boniface occur. Filelfo says that he served on 14 embassies, a statement not only unsupported by evidence, but impossible in itself. Filelfo does not mention the only embassy in which we know for certain that Dante was engaged, that to the town of San Gemignano in May 1300. From the 15th of June to the 15th of August 1300, he held the office of prior, which was the source of all the miseries of his life. The spirit of faction had again broken out in Florence. The two rival families were the Cerchi and the Donati, the first of great wealth, but recent origin, the last of ancient ancestry, but poor. A quarrel had arisen in Pistoia between the two branches of the Cancellieri, the Bianchi and Neri, the whites and the blacks. The quarrel spread to Florence. The Donati took the side of the blacks, the Cerchi of the whites. Pope Boniface was asked to mediate and sent Cardinal Matteo di Acquasparta to maintain peace. He arrived just as Dante entered upon his office as prior. The cardinal effected nothing, but Dante and his colleagues banished the heads of the rival parties in different directions to a distance from the capital. The blacks were sent to Città della Pieve in the Tuscan mountains. The whites, among whom was Dante's dearest friend Guido Cavalcanti, to Serezzano in the unhealthy Maremma. After the expiration of Dante's office, both parties returned. Guido Cavalcanti, so ill with fever that he shortly afterwards died. At a meeting held in the Church of the Holy Trinity, the whites were denounced as Ghibellines, enemies of the Pope. The blacks sought for vengeance. Their leader, Corso Donati, hastened to Rome and persuaded Boniface VIII to send for Charles of Valois, brother of the French king, Philip the Fair, to act as peacemaker, so-called. The priors sent at the end of September four ambassadors to the Pope, one of whom, according to the chronicler Dino, was Dante. There are, however, improbabilities in the story, and the passage quoted in support of it bears marks of later interpolation. He never again saw the towers of his native city. Charles of Valois, after visiting the Pope at Anagni, retraced his steps to Florence, entering the city on All Saints' Day and taking up his abode in the Oltrarno. Corso Donati, who had been banished a second time, returned in force and summoned the blacks to arms. The prisons were broken open, the Podesta driven from the town, the Cerchi confined within their houses. A third of the city was destroyed with fire and sword. By the help of Charles, the blacks were victorious. They appointed Conte de Gabriele of Gubbio as Podesta, a man devoted to their interests. More than 600 whites were condemned to exile and cast as beggars upon the world. On the 27th of January, 1302, Dante, with four others of the white party, was charged before the Podesta, Conte de Gabriele, with barateria, or corrupt jobbery and peculation when in office, and, not appearing, condemned to pay a fine of 5,000 lira of small florins. If the money was not paid within 3 days, their property was to be destroyed and laid waste. If they did not pay the fine, they were to be exiled for 2 years from Tuscany. In any case, they were never again to hold office in the Republic. The charge in Dante's case was obviously preposterous, though ingeniously devised, for he was known to be at the time in somewhat straitened circumstances, and had recently been in control of certain public works. But of all sins, that of barratry was one of the most hateful to him. No doubt the papal finger may be traced in the affair. On the 10th of March, Dante and 14 others were condemned to be burned alive if they should come into the power of the Republic. Similar sentences were passed in September and October 1315. The sentence was not formally reversed till 1494, under the government of the Medici. Leonardo Bruni, who accepts the story of the embassy to Rome, states that Dante received the news of his banishment in that city, and at once joined the other exiles at Siena. How he escaped arrest in the Papal States is not explained. The exiles met first at Gargonza, a castle between Siena and Arezzo, and then at Arezzo itself. They joined themselves to the Ghibellines, to which party the Podesta Uguccione della Fagiuola belonged. The Ghibellines, however, were divided amongst themselves, and the more strict Ghibellines were not disposed to favour the cause of the white Guelphs. On the 8th of June, 1302, however, a meeting was held at San Gaudenzio, a place in the Florentine territory, Dante's presence at which is proved by documentary evidence, and an alliance was there made with the powerful Ghibelline clan of the Ubaldini. The exiles remained at Arezzo till the summer of 1304. In September 1303, the fleur-de-lis had entered Agnani, and Christ had a second time been made prisoner in the person of his vicar. At the instigation of Philip the Fair, William of Nogaret and Sciarra Colonna had entered the papal palace at Agnani, and had insulted, and it is said even beaten, the aged pontiff under his own roof. Boniface did not survive the insult long, but died in the following month. He was succeeded by Benedict the 11th, and in March the Cardinal da Prato came to Florence, sent by the new pope to make peace. The people received him with enthusiasm, and ambassadors came to him from the whites, and he did his best to reconcile the two parties. But the blacks resisted all his efforts. He shook the dust from off his feet and departed, leaving the city under an interdict. Foiled by the calumnies and machinations of the one party, the cardinal gave his countenance to the other. It happened that Corso Donati and the heads of the black party were absent at Pistoia. Da Prato advised the whites to attack Florence, deprived of its heads and impaired by recent fire. An army was collected of 16,000 foot and 9,000 horse. Communications were opened with the Ghibellines of Bologna and Romagna, and a futile attempt was made to enter Florence from Lastra, the failure of which further disorganized the party. Dante had, however, already separated from the ill-conditioned and foolish company of common party politicians, who rejected his counsels of wisdom, and had learnt that he must henceforth form a party by himself. In 1303 he had left Arezzo and gone to Forli in Romagna, of which city Scarpetta degli Ordelaffi was lord. To him, according to Flavius Blundus, the historian, who died in 1484, a native of the place, Dante acted for a time as secretary. From Forli, Dante probably went to Bartolomeo della Scala, lord of Verona, where the country of the great Lombard gave him his first refuge and his first hospitable reception. The Grande, to whom he afterwards dedicated the Paradiso, was then a boy. Bartolomeo died in 1304, and it is possible that Dante may have remained in Verona till his death. We must consider, if we would understand the real nature of Dante's Ghibellinism, that he had been born and bred a Guelph. But he saw that the conditions of the time were altered, and that other dangers menaced the welfare of his country. There was no fear now that Florence, Siena, Pisa, Arezzo should be razed to the ground in order that the castle of the Lord might overlook the humble cottages of his contented subjects. But there was danger lest Italy should be torn in sunder by its own jealousies and passions, and lest the fair domain bounded by the sea and the Alps should never properly assert the force of its individuality, and should present a contemptible contrast to a united France and a confederated Germany. Sick with petty quarrels and dissensions, Dante strained his eyes towards the hills for the appearance of a universal monarch, raised above the jars of faction and the spur of ambition, under whom each country, each city, each man might, under the institutions best suited to it, lead the life and do the work for which it was best fitted. United in spiritual harmony with the Vicar of Christ, he should show for the first time to the world an example of a government where the strongest force and the highest wisdom were interpenetrated by all that God had given to the world of piety and justice. In this sense, and in no other, was Dante a Ghibelline. The vision was never realized. The hope was never fulfilled. Not till 500 years later did Italy become united, and the greyhound of deliverance chase from city to city the wolf of cupidity. But is it possible to say that the dream did not work its own realization, or to deny that the high ideal of the poet, after inspiring a few minds as lofty as his own, has become embodied in the constitution of a state which acknowledges no stronger bond of union than a common worship of the exile's indignant and impassioned verse? It is very difficult to determine with exactness the order and the place of Dante's wanderings. Many cities and castles in Italy have claimed the honour of giving him shelter, or of being for a time the home of his inspired muse. He certainly spent some time with Count Guido Salvatico in the Casentino near the sources of the Arno, probably in the castle of Porciano, and with Uguccione in the castle of Fagiuolo in the mountains of Urbino. After this he is said to have visited the University of Bologna, and in August 1306 we find him at Padua. Cardinal Napoleon Orsini, the legate of the French Pope Clement V, had put Bologna under a ban, dissolved the university, and driven the professors to the northern city. In May or June 1307 the same cardinal collected the whites at Arezzo and tried to induce the Florentines to recall them. The name of Dante is found attached to a document signed by the whites in the church of San Gaudenzio in the Mugello. This enterprise came to nothing. Dante retired to the castle of Moruello Malespina in the Lunigiana, where the marble ridges of the mountains of Carrara descend in precipitous slopes to the Gulf of Spezia. From this time till the arrival of the Emperor Henry VII in Italy in October 1310, all is uncertain. His old enemy, Corso Donati, had at last allied himself with Uguccione della Fagiuola, the leader of the Ghibellines. Dante thought it possible that this might lead to his return. But in 1308, Corso was declared a traitor, attacked in his house, put to flight, and killed. Dante lost his last hope. He left Tuscany and went to Can Grande della Scala at Verona. From this place it is thought that he visited the University of Paris in 1309, studied in the Rue du Fouarre, and went on into the Low Countries. That he ever crossed the Channel, or went to Oxford, or himself saw where the heart of Henry, son of Richard, Earl of Cornwall, murdered by his cousin Guy de Montfort in 1271, was still venerated on the Thames, may safely be disbelieved. The only evidence for it is in the commentary of John of Serravalle, Bishop of Fermo, who lived a century later, had no special opportunity of knowing, and was writing for the benefit of two English bishops. The election in 1308 of Henry of Luxembourg as emperor stirred again his hopes of a deliverer. At the end of 1310, in a letter to the princes and peoples of Italy, he proclaimed the coming of the Saviour. At Milan he did personal homage to his sovereign. The Florentines made every preparation to resist the emperor. Dante wrote from the Casentino a letter dated the 31st of March, 1311, in which he rebuked them for their stubbornness and obstinacy. Henry still lingered in Lombardy at the siege of Cremona, when Dante, on the 16th of April, 1311, in a celebrated epistle, upbraided his delay, argued that the crown of Italy was to be won on the Arno rather than on the Po, and urged the tarrying emperor to hew the rebellious Florentines like Agag in pieces before the Lord. Henry was as deaf to this exhortation as the Florentines themselves. After reducing Lombardy, he passed from Genoa to Pisa, and on the 29th of June, 1312, was crowned by some cardinals in the church of St. John Lateran at Rome, the Vatican being in the hands of his adversary, King Robert of Naples. Then at length he moved towards Tuscany by way of Umbria. Leaving Cortona and Arezzo, he reached Florence on the 19th of September. He did not dare to attack it, but returned in November to Pisa. In the summer of the following year, he prepared to invade the kingdom of Naples, but in the neighborhood of Siena he caught a fever and died at the monastery of Buonconvento on the 24th of August, 1313. He lies in the Campo Santo of Pisa, and the hopes of Dante and his party were buried in his grave. After the death of the Emperor Henry, Bruni tells us, Dante passed the rest of his life as an exile, sojourning in various places throughout Lombardy, Tuscany, and the Romagna, under the protection of various lords, until at length he retired to Ravenna, where he ended his life. Very little can be added to this meagre story. There is reason for supposing that he stayed at Gubbio with Busoni dei Raffaelli, and tradition assigns him a cell in the monastery of Santa Croce di Ponte Avellana, in the same district, situated on the slopes of Catria, one of the highest peaks of the Apennines in that region. After the death of the French Pope Clement V, Dante addressed a letter dated the 14th of July, 1314, to the cardinals in conclave, urging them to elect an Italian pope. About this time he came to Lucca, then lately conquered by his friend Uguccione. Here he completed the last cantos of the Purgatory, which he dedicated to Uguccione, and here he must have become acquainted with Gentucca, whose name had been whispered to him by her countrymen on the slopes of the Mountain of Purification. That the intimacy between the world-worn poet and the young married lady, who is thought to be identifiable with Gentucca Morla, wife of one Cosciorino Fondoro, was other than blameless, is quite incredible. In August 1315 was fought the Battle of Monte Catini, a day of humiliation and mourning for the Guelphs. Guccione made but little use of his victory, and the Florentines marked their vengeance on his adviser by condemning Dante yet once again to death if he should ever come into their power. In the beginning of the following year, Uguccione lost both his cities of Pisa and Lucca. At this time, Dante was offered an opportunity of returning to Florence. The conditions given to the exiles were that they should pay a fine and walk in the dress of humiliation to the Church of St. John, and there do penance for their offences. Dante refused to tolerate this shame, and the letter is still extant in which he declines to enter Florence except with honour, secure that the means of life will not fail him, and that in any corner of the world he will be able to gaze at the sun and the stars and meditate on the sweetest truths of philosophy. He preferred to take refuge with his most illustrious protector, Cangrande della Scala of Verona, then a young man of 25, rich, liberal, and the favored head of the Ghibelline party. His name has been immortalized by an eloquent panegyric in the 17th canto of the Paradiso. Whilst on a visit at the court of Verona, he maintained, on the 10th of January, 1320, the philosophical thesis De Aqua et Terra, on the levels of land and water, which is included in his minor works. The last 3 years of his life were spent at Ravenna, under the protection of Guido da Polenta. In his service, Dante undertook an embassy to the Venetians. He failed in the object of his mission, and, returning disheartened and broken in spirit through the unhealthy lagoons, caught a fever, and died in Ravenna on the 14th of September, 1321. His bones still repose there. His doom of exile has been reversed by the Union of Italy, which has made the city of his birth and the various cities of his wanderings component members of a common country. His son Piero, who wrote a commentary on the Divina Commedia, settled as a lawyer in Verona and died in 1364. His daughter Beatrice lived as a nun in Ravenna, dying at some time between 1350, when Boccaccio brought her a present of 10 gold crowns from a Florentine guild, and 1370. His direct line became extinct in 1509. Of Dante's works, that by which he is known to all the educated world, and in virtue of which he holds his place as one of the half-dozen greatest writers of all time, is, of course, the Commedia. The poem is absolutely unique in literature. It may safely be said that at no other epoch of the world's history could such a work have been produced. Dante was steeped in all the learning, which in its way was considerable, of his time. He had read the Summa Theologica of Aquinas, the Tresor of his master Brunetto, and other encyclopedic works available in that age. He was familiar with all that was then known of the Latin classical and post-classical authors. Further, he was a deep and original political thinker, who had himself borne a prominent part in practical politics. He was born into a generation in which almost every man of education habitually wrote verse, as indeed their predecessors had been doing for the last 50 years. Vernacular poetry had come late into Italy, and had hitherto, save for a few didactic or devotional treatises hitched into rough rhyme, been exclusively lyric in form. Amatory at first, later, chiefly in the hands of Guittone of Arezzo and Guittone Cavalcanti, taking an ethical and metaphysical tone, it had never fully shaken off the provincial influence under which it had started, and of which Dante himself shows considerable traces. The age also was unique, though the two great events which made the 15th century a turning point in the world's history, the invention of printing and the discovery of the New World, to which might perhaps be added the intrusion of Islam into Europe, were still far in the future. But the age was essentially one of great men, of free thought and free speech, of brilliant and daring action, whether for good or evil. It is easy to understand how Dante's bitterest scorn is reserved for those sorry souls who lived without infamy and without renown, displeasing to God and to his enemies. The time was thus propitious for the production of a great imaginative work, and the man was ready who should produce it. It called for a prophet, and the prophet said, "Here I am." Dante, says an acute writer, is not, as Homer is, the father of poetry springing in the freshness and simplicity of childhood out of the arms of Mother Earth. He is rather like Noah, the father of a second poetical world, to whom he pours forth his prophetic song, fraught with the wisdom and the experience of the old world. Thus the Commedia, though often classed for want of a better description among epic poems, is totally different in method and construction from all other poems of that kind. Its hero is the narrator himself. The incidents do not modify the course of the story. The place of episodes is taken by theological or metaphysical disquisitions. The world through which the poet takes his readers is peopled not with characters of heroic story, but with men and women known personally or by repute to him, and those for whom he wrote. Its aim is not to delight, but to reprove, to rebuke, to exhort, to form men's characters by teaching them what courses of life will meet with reward, what with penalty hereafter. To put into verse, as the poet says, things difficult to think. For such new matter, a new vehicle was needed. We have Bembo's authority for believing that the Terza Rima surpassed, if at all, only by the ancient hexameter as a measure equally adaptable to sustain narrative, to debate, to fierce invective, to clear-cut picture, and to trenchant epigram, was first employed by Dante. The action of the Commedia opens in the early morning of the Thursday before Easter, in the year 1300. The poet finds himself lost in a forest, escaping from which he has his way barred by a wolf, a lion, and a leopard. All this, like the rest of the poem, is highly symbolical. This branch of the subject is too vast to be entered on at any length here. But so far as this passage is concerned, it may be said that it seems to indicate that, at this period of his life, about the age of 35, Dante went through some experience akin to what is now called conversion. Having led up till then the ordinary life of a cultivated Florentine of good family, taking his part in public affairs, military and civil, as an hereditary member of the predominant Guelph party, dallying in prose, with which all its beauty and passion is full of the conceits familiar to the 13th century, and in verse which, save for the excellence of its execution, differs in no way from that of his old age and death, predecessors with the memory of his lost love, studying more seriously, perhaps, than most of his associates. Possibly, travelling a little, gradually or suddenly, he became convinced that all was not well with him, and that not by leading, however blamelessly, the active life could he save his soul. The strong vein of mysticism found in so many of the deepest thinkers of that age and conspicuous in Dante's mind no doubt played its part. His efforts to free himself from the forest of worldly cares were impeded by the temptations of the world, cupidity, including ambition, the pride of life and the lusts of the flesh, symbolized by the three beasts. But a helper is at hand. Virgil appears and explains that he has a commission from three ladies on high to guide him. The ladies are the Blessed Virgin, St. Lucy, whom, for some reason never yet explained, Dante seems to have regarded as, in a special sense, his protector, and Beatrice. In Virgil, we are apparently intended to see the symbol of what Dante calls philosophy, what we should rather call natural religion. Beatrice, standing for theology, or rather revealed religion. Under Virgil's escort, Dante is led through the two lower realms of the next world, Hell and Purgatory, meeting on the way with many persons illustrious or notorious in recent or remoter times, as well as many well enough known then in Tuscany and the neighbouring states, but who, without the immortality, often unenviable, that the poet has conferred on them, would long ago have been forgotten. Popes, kings, emperors, poets and warriors, Florentine citizens of all degrees, are there found, some doomed to hopeless punishment, others expiating their offences in milder torments and looking forward to deliverance in due time. It is remarkable to notice how rarely, if ever, Dante allows political sympathy or antagonism to influence him in his distribution of judgment. Hell is conceived as a vast conical hollow reaching to the centre of the earth. It has three great divisions, corresponding to Aristotle's three classes of vices, incontinence, brutishness, and malice. The first are outside the walls of the city of Dis, the second among whom are included unbelievers, tyrants, suicides, unnatural offenders, usurers, are within. The first apparently on the same level as those without, the rest separated from them by a steep descent of broken rocks. It should be said that many Dante scholars hold that Aristotle's brutishness has no place in Dante's scheme, but the symmetry of the arrangement, the special reference made to that division, and certain expressions used elsewhere by Dante seem to make it probable that he would here, as in most other cases, have followed his master in philosophy. The sinners, by malice, which includes all forms of fraud or treachery, are divided from the last by a yet more formidable barrier. They lie at the bottom of a pit, the depth of which is not stated, with vertical sides, and accessible only by supernatural means. A monster named Geryon, bearing the poets down on his back. The torments here are of a more terrible, often of a loathsome character. Ignominy is added to pain, and the nature of Dante's demeanour towards the sinners changes from pity to hatred. At the very bottom of the pit is Lucifer, immovably fixed in ice. Climbing down his limbs, they reach the centre of the earth, whence a cranny conducts them back to the surface, at the foot of the purgatorial mountain, which they reach as Easter Day is dawning. Before the actual purgatory is attained, they have to climb for the latter half of the day and rest at night. The occupants of this outer region are those who have delayed repentance till death was upon them. They include many of the most famous men of the last 30 years. In the morning, the gate is opened, and purgatory proper is entered. This is divided into 7 terraces, corresponding to the 7 deadly sins, which encircle the mountain and have to be reached by a series of steep climbs, compared by Dante in one instance to the path from Florence to Samminiato. The penalties are not degrading, but rather tests of patience or endurance, and in several cases Dante has to bear a share in them as he passes. On the summit is the earthly paradise. Here Beatrice appears in a mystical pageant. Virgil departs, leaving Dante in her charge. By her he is led through the various spheres of which, according to both the astronomy and the theology of the time, heaven is composed, to the supreme heaven, or Empyrean, the seat of the Godhead. For one moment there is granted him the intuitive vision of the deity, and the comprehension of all mysteries, which is the ultimate goal of mystical theology. His will is wholly blended with that of God, and the poem ends. synopsis. Inferno. The poem begins on the night before Good Friday in the year 1300, halfway along our life's path, as he says. Dante is 35 years old, half of the biblical life expectancy of 70, lost in a dark wood, perhaps allegorically contemplating suicide, as wood is figured in Canto 13, and the mention of suicide is made in Canto 1 of Purgatorio, with, "This man has not yet seen his last evening, but through his madness was so close to it that there was hardly time to turn about," implying that when Virgil came to him he was on the verge of suicide, or morally passing the point of no return. Assailed by beasts he cannot evade, a lion, a leopard, and a she-wolf, and unable to find the straight way, also translatable as right way to salvation, symbolized by the sun behind the mountain. Conscious that he is ruining himself and that he is falling into a deep place where the sun is silent, Dante is at last rescued by Virgil, and the two of them begin their journey to the underworld. Each sin's punishment in the Inferno is a contrapasso, a symbolic instance of poetic justice. For example, fortune tellers have to walk forwards with their heads on backwards, unable to see what is ahead because they tried to do so in life. Allegorically, the Inferno represents the Christian soul seeing sin for what it really is, and the three beasts represent three types of sin: the self-indulgent, the violent, and the malicious. These three types of sin also provide the three main divisions of Dante's hell: upper hell, the first five circles, for the self-indulgent sins, circles 6 and 7 for the violent sins, and circles 8 and 9 for the malicious sins. Canto 1. In the middle of his life, Dante has left the straightforward pathway and is lost in a dark forest. He tries to regain the path by climbing a mountain, but his way is barred by a leopard, a lion, and a she-wolf. Each creature represents a different sin. Virgil appears and offers to show him another way, one that leads through hell and purgatory. After that, a more worthy guide, Beatrice, will lead him to paradise. Virgil, as a pagan, is not allowed to go there. Dante gladly adopts Virgil as his leader. Canto 2. The end of the day has come, and Dante is having doubts. He does not feel worthy enough to undertake his journey. Virgil accuses him of cowardice and tells of how the Virgin Mary turned to Saint Lucia, who in turn asked for Beatrice, Dante's love, to go down into Limbo, where Virgil resides. There Beatrice, with voice angelical, asked Virgil to assist Dante, whose way was impeded. At this Dante is heartened and declares to Virgil that one soul will is in us both. Canto 3. As Dante and Virgil enter hell's antechamber, they see words inscribed above its gate, and hear the cries of the indecisive, the first group of damned souls. These moral cowards, rejected by heaven yet ignored by hell, have to chase a banner whilst being plagued by hornets and flies. Charon the boatman refuses to carry Dante, a living soul, across the river Acheron on hell's outer boundary, but Virgil declares that heaven wills it. A fierce wind picks up, and Dante swoons. Canto 4. Virgil shows Dante the mournful shadows of virtuous non-Christians like himself who haunt Limbo, hell's first circle, and suffer the spiritual torment of forever seeking God in vain. Virgil speaks about Christ's descent into hell and his salvation of several Old Testament patriarchs. A glowing light reveals four other great pagan figures: Homer, Horace, Ovid, and Lucan. The pilgrim receives a splendid castle of light in the distance, where the most renowned non-Christian philosophers, poets, and warriors dwell. Canto 5. Dante and Virgil descend from the first circle to the second. Minos stands at the entrance, judging transgressors and selecting a place in hell for each of them. The lustful are eternally tossed upon the infernal hurricane. Virgil answers Dante's question by describing the shades of famous lovers: Semiramis of Assyria, Dido of Carthage, Helen of Troy, Achilles, Paris, Paolo Malatesta, and Francesca da Rimini. Dante is saddened by the story of the last of these. Canto 6. The gluttons, denizens of the third circle, are sunk in fetid mud and pelted by hail, rain, and snow. Virgil placates the three-headed Cerberus, their bellicose guardian, by feeding his appetite with fistfuls of earth. Chaco, a contemporary of Dante, approaches the pair of travellers and makes a political prophecy about Florence. Dante asks Virgil about the Last Judgment as the two poets approach the next circle. Canto 7. At Virgil's behest, Plutus, god of material wealth, dissipates into thin air between the third and fourth circles. The poets watch the noisy hoarders and the spendthrifts rolling huge weights at one another. After discussing fortune's distribution of temporal riches, they reach the river Styx, the second of hell's rivers, which is the fifth circle. Here are mired the wrathful, who tear at one another, and the sluggish, who doze beneath the slime. Dante and Virgil come to the foot of a high tower. Canto 8. Dante realizes that the fires on the top of the tower are a signal to the city of Dis. Phlegius quickly appears, and the two poets are ferried across the Styx. An angry shadow, Filippo Argenti, rises up from the mire and tries to attack the boat. Repelled by Virgil, he is then viciously attacked by the other souls. The poets disembark at the gate of Dis. They are denied access by the demonic angels within. Virgil goes alone to speak with them, to no avail. The poets must wait for help from heaven. Canto 9. The poets are waiting for divine assistance at the gate of Dis. Unnerved by Virgil's anxiety, Dante asks him if he knows the way through hell. Virgil reassures him. Three furies appear at the tower, shrieking and tearing at their breasts and invoking Medusa. Dante shields his gaze to avoid being turned to stone. An angel makes a dramatic entrance before opening the gate. The sarcophagi of the groaning heretics burn beyond. Canto 10. Dante and Virgil walk around the tombs of the heretics who sought temporal bliss. This sin of the intellect, though not a source of sinful action, lies between incontinence and violence. Hearing a fellow Tuscan speak, Farinata rises up from one of the graves. Farinata's political tirade against Florence is interpreted by the appearance of Cavalcante de Cavalcante, who asks about his son Guido. Dante is intrigued to discover that the damned can foresee the future and recall the past, but have no knowledge of the present. Canto 11. Continuing their visit of the heretical sixth circle, poet and pilgrim are overcome by the foul stench wafting up from the abyss ahead. Both pause and read the inscription on the tomb of Pope Anastasius II. Seeing Dante's willingness to learn, Virgil instructs him further on the subtle classification of punishment in hell before finally urging him on as it is nearly dawn. Canto 12.